Well, I have 7.9, so I'm just using all the minutes.
Okay. I have here two pages for you, pages 1 and 2.
Okay.
And we study the palaeoates. There are also pages 3 and 4 on the back side, but we're not going to get to that. We just don't have enough time. Now, page 1, where he quotes the palaeoates on the top right, that's a section called Avas Habonim Vahabonos. That's the love for parents and children. And again, it's a long presentation. I'll just give you all that we have to know for tonight's study. He says that the love of parents for children is built into human nature because they are part of himself. They are flesh and blood, as we would say. But nevertheless, we have to make sure that this love, which is very natural, should be controlled. It should be disciplined. He quotes a famous phrase in Chazal called Ava Mekalkela Sashura, that sometimes love to the extreme, if it's not reined in, is not going to be for the benefit of those who are loved. And therefore parents have to find a very sensitive balance between, on the one hand, love, and on the other hand, what he calls tochacha or yisurim, liyaser b'no laharvos bo gaguim. He should have a sense of guiding his children in the right path. And therefore, a person should be careful to have, on the one hand, ava, and sometimes that love for his children is musteret. Musteret means it's not always exposed, it's hidden, like my Rebbe used to say about the love of his father for him, was ava musteret. It wasn't always expressed externally. But on the other side, tochacha megula, there has to be tochacha. Tochacha means to send the child, educate him, train him on the right path, make sure he's going in the right way. And he says that we also have to be careful not to create jealousy between children. Shelo yishana lebein ben abonim, or not to show favoritism. He has a whole section here about how we have to speak to our children b'loshon raka, in a very soft kind of voice, never to raise our voice out of anger. And then he goes on to say that the overall approach of parents is lefi daito umidosov shel ben.
What did you say the title of this is?
This is called Avas Habonim Vahabonos. In my text, it's on page Chaf Beis, but you know, you have a different text. See if you can find it. It's very early in the book. And he says that the nature of our relationship as parents with our children should be very much individualized. It all depends upon the child in order to raise the child in the right way. And at the end of this section, he says, Ve'ha'ikar, and this you'll see on your page as number one. He says the most important guiding rule or overriding principle in raising children is lasos nachas ruach lifnei avinu shebashamayim, that the goal and the objective of every act, every relationship, of every interaction of child rearing, of raising children, has to be for the purpose of doing God's will. And therefore he says, and here you want to emphasize this, yishtadel b'chol oz v'satzumos, he should put in all the effort, spare no effort, lilamed es bonov Torah, to teach his children Torah. And again, the title of this lecture is Avas Habonim Habonos. He's not differentiating here between the boys and the girls. We have to raise the girls as well to teach them Torah. He goes on to praise our role. Our God has put us in a special role as parents. Matov chalkenu manoim garolenu. How successful we possibly could be if we raise our children for the study of Torah. And Yismacha ish biyotzei chalotzav v'olamazeh, how much pleasure and pride he can derive from his children in this world and in the next world. And he should really put himself all out. He calls it mesiras nafsho, to almost sacrifice himself. Lishtadil b'chol nafsho b'chol ma'odo, to give all the effort of his soul, his physicality, lebal yu banav hamiyaret, so that, heaven forbid, his children should not be ignorant of the Torah. And this is the derech hayosher, this is the right way to raise our children for the crown of Torah. Now what I'd like to study with you is a little bit of insight about how to teach Torah to our children from the great Chassam Sofer. I've mentioned him in these classes numerous times, and the Chassam Sofer, who lived about 150 years ago, has an entire, what shall I say, lineage of children and grandchildren who went in his approach and took his legacy and passed it on. So you'll notice numbers 2 and 3 on the right column. Both of these are written by either the Chassam Sofer himself or one of his descendants, Rabbi Kiva Sofer, and they all focus on how much a parent has to be involved and dedicated to the Torah education of his children. In the first paragraph of these two paragraphs, he has a new and unique interpretation of a very famous statement of Chazal, which Rashi quotes in his commentary on the Torah. It says, with regard to the mitzvah of preparing the candelabra in the Beis HaMikdash, Vayas Kein Aaron. Those are the three words that appear in Sefer Bamidbar in the 8th chapter. And Rashi, quoting the Sifri, answers the question without even asking it. Why did the Torah have to tell you Vayas Kein Aaron, that Aaron lived up to the instructions? I mean, it seems obvious. And the Sifri says, Malame, this teaches us Shaloshina, that he never deviated from the command of the Torah as far as the menorah is concerned. He was always consistent. So the question that we're asking is, what's the big deal? The Torah wants to go out of its way to praise Aaron, who's the Kadosh Hashem. He's sanctified to God. That's all he cares about, is how to fulfill the will of God. He sees himself as a servant of God. And now you're telling me that he got a command, he received a mitzvah mandate from Hashem to prepare the candelabra, and he was mekayim that mitzvah? He fulfilled that mitzvah? What's the big deal? What's all the taram? What's all the excitement here? Do we ever think otherwise? Did the thought ever cross our minds that Aaron would do anything but fulfill the will of God? Malami Shaloshina. He didn't deviate. Now we're going to see a brilliant insight into what does it mean Malami Shaloshina. Now, just by way of introduction, the words Malamich Loshina have a different meaning. They should not be translated simply in a very superficial way as that he fulfilled the will of God. It's much more than that. Malamich Loshina means that he was continuous. What do I mean by continuous? He was reliable. One time, another time, another time.
That's near Tamid, in the morning, in the evening.
Correct, there's a certain continuity here. Loshina. You know, you have people who have very good beginnings, but not necessarily good endings. You know, they start on the right foot, but they don't have that constancy. They don't have that reliability. So let's now try to analyze what's going on. At the end of Sefer Shmos, there are two mitzvahs that are given to the Kohanim. One mitzvah is with regard to the Neros, the menorah, and the other is with regard to the Ketores. And both of these mitzvahs were meant to bring about a certain, you may remember I spoke about this concept in the past, a skula. A skula means it has a certain power, a certain inherent metaphysical power that's inside this action. In the case of Neros, of the candelabra, the Gemara in Perek Bamei Madlikin in Masechta Shabbos tells us that what's the skula power of preparing the candelabra? It's Havin Le Bonim Talmidei Chachamim. His sons, his offspring, will be dedicated to the study of Torah. They'll become Torah scholars. What is the skula power of the Ketores? And the Gemara tells us that the skula power of the Ketores is Me'asheres, Miloshon Ashir. How would you translate the word Ashir into English? With an ayin, a rich person. So if you want to get rich, get involved in Haketores HaKetores. There's only one problem.
What is HaKetores?
The Ketores is the incense that had to be burnt on the Mizbeach. Do you remember that? I don't know how they translate Ketores into English, but
yeah, some, you can't put 13 in there.
Yeah, it was made of 13 different spices and herbs and so forth.
You shouldn't put urine, but some people said it would
right,
work, but it's not
right,
good.
Right, so now the problem is like this. I would like to get wealthy. I would also like to raise my children to become Torah scholars, but I can't do both. Why? Because the halacha requires that simultaneously, as the Neros are being prepared and lit, the Ketores is being brought on the Mizbeach. So Aaron now faces an either-or situation. His choice is either to get involved and dedicated to the Neros, and then gain that school of power that his children will be scholars, or to get involved in bringing the Ketores.
You have to actually bring it?
Ketores meaning to burn it on the Mizbeach.
Okay, so yeah? Breaking it doesn't count.
No, that doesn't count. You know, we're talking about the actual implementation in the Mikdash itself. Oh. So what does Aaron choose if he has to decide between Neros and Ketores? Which of the two does he choose?
The Neros.
The Neros, right. Why does he choose the Neros? So there's a pasuk in Tehillim which really typifies or expresses this choice. And David HaMelech in Tehillim says, Tov li Torah picha, me alfei zahav kesef. Your Torah, Hashem, is worth more to me than thousands upon thousands of gold and silver coins. Okay, so Aaron made that choice decision. He decided to choose the Neros. However, here's where Rav Sofer comes up with an insight. What's the big deal? The big deal is the following. We have a principle called Efsho Lekayim Shnehem, which means that if I want to achieve two great things, two great mitzvos, I can sometimes do both of them. Maybe not simultaneously, but I can do them one after the other. So take, for example, on Yom Rishon. On Yom Rishon, Aaron should dedicate himself to the Neros. But on Yom Sheni, let him give the Neros to somebody else, and he'll dedicate himself to the Ketores. This way, he'll get the benefit of both. He'll get the best of both worlds. That's what the Gemara wants to teach us. The Sifri and Rashi quotes it, Melamed Shlo Shina. He was consistent. He never deviated. He never allowed himself to take himself away, even for one day, from the Neros, and dedicate himself instead to the Ketores. He was so eager, and this was his very essence, that his children, his offspring, should be Talmidei Chachamim. He didn't give up on even one opportunity to prepare the Neros what's called Atavos HaNeros in the menorah. Why? Because of the school of power of Talmidei Chachamim. You know, you never know when you'll hit payday. You know, on which day in particular you did it in the best way. And so there's a constancy here where Aaron is not even going to give up one day of opportunity to prepare the Neros. Why? Because of the school of power that's inherent in the Neros to bring about Bonav Talmidei Chachamim. That's number two on your page. And now we fast forward to number three. And we're going to take a look at another line in the Peleoetz. When the Peleoetz talks about teaching your children Torah, and as we said before, that becomes absolutely central in this presentation, he emphasizes Torah Shebal Peh. That becomes like primary in the perspective of the Peleoetz. You know that we have two Torahs. We have the written Torah and we have the oral Torah. So you and I might have thought that maybe we should put the emphasis on the written Torah. But that's not the approach of the Peleoetz. He says, no. We want to shoot for to win the whole pact, you know, the whole lottery. And how do we do so? We're not going to limit ourselves to Torah Shebichsav, but we're going to shoot for Torah Sheba'al Peh. So here I want to study with you another presentation of the same author, the Chasam Sofer. This is in one of his drashos. And he emphasizes this concept of Torah Sheba'al Peh. And here, in order to appreciate what he's going to suggest here, and I think it's a pretty revolutionary idea, I'm going to ask you for your knee-jerk response to the following question. What would you suggest as a curriculum for young children in Torah? Here are your two options. One option would be, let's start, as the children are young, with the written Torah, and let's postpone the study of the oral Torah, the Torah Sheba'al Peh, until the child is much older. It may take the child years upon years to master the Torah Shebichsav. Maybe by the time the child is bar mitzvah or bat mitzvah, he or she could be ready for Torah Sheba'al Peh. That's one option. The other option is to integrate both of them together, even as the children are very young. And instead of postponing the study of Torah Sheba'al Peh, to introduce Torah Sheba'al Peh together with Torah Shebichtav from the time that the children are very young. What would be your logical response if you were setting up a curriculum?
Both, if you can do both.
Well, let me ask you this. If you were taking a college course, Lahavdil, right, in math, let's say, and there was, you know, math 1.1, those are the basics, and then there's a higher level of math, would you be studying both of these at the same time? That was a rhetorical question. What I meant to say is, obviously, you'd want to first master the basics and then go on to the more complex, the deeper or more profound, more advanced level of knowledge.
You mean to say that there is no base level of both? That if you learn them both together, one is more advanced than the other one.
Right. In other words, what I mean to say is that if you were taking a course in Torah Shebichsav, that would occupy your mind for years and years. You know, there's so much to know and
well,
so much to study.
It does.
Right, so I'm just suggesting, again, I'm only doing this to be sort of pedagogical and dramatic about what I see here as a revolutionary chiddush. And I'm trying to suggest that if not, you know, before I read this piece and I understood the presentation here of the Chasam Sofer's curriculum, I thought intuitively, this was my knee-jerk response, that the curriculum should go from level A to level B, and we should separate between the two. First, master the Torah Shebichsav, and when the child gets a little bit more mature and older, and he's ready for the deeper meanings, at that point we should introduce Torah Sheba'al Peh. and the Chassam Sofer doesn't tolerate it. He says the following. I'm going to read some of his words. Ein lilmod im hanaorim harbei tor shebechsav lefi pshuto. I am absolutely opposed to a curriculum in which we teach the na'orim, the children, lots and lots of Torah Shebechsav over the course of a long period of time. Lefi pshuto. Pshuto means, as Rashi always invokes the principle, Ein mikri yotzev de pshuto. Read the Torah and translate it into your vernacular. Understand it on the simplest level. That's called pshat. Terem, before we teach the child shas, you know, comments of the Gemara on the Torah Shebechsav, or drashos from Chazal, which are in the Medrash or in the Sifri, Sifra, Mechilta, you know, the whole world of the oral Torah. He says that's not the, all this is with the word aim, meaning put a negative sign. This is something that the Chassam Sofer absolutely rejects. And he says why. And in the paragraph that starts Anumat Mihim, he tells us, based on a Gemara in Shabbos, that although the study of Torah can be read kipshuto, and you can translate the words, but despite that principle of Ein mikri yotzev de pshuto, the Gemara advocates that we teach gmirnole lekula shas, that we teach him all of the statements of Chazal. What does that mean? He says the following, that if you teach your children just Torah Shebechsav lefi pshuto, just the simple reading and translation of the text without any Gemara, then you run a very serious risk. And it's a very hazardous kind of program. He says the following, that through all of Jewish history, the tradition and the methodology of studying Torah that was passed on ish mipi ish, from one father to his son over all the generations, was always to integrate both Torah Shebechsav and Torah Shebaal Peh together. And he goes on to say that if we raise our children in their younger years on Torah Shebechsav alone, just on the written Torah, lefi pshuto, he says we run a great risk. And he says that the children get so used to understanding the Torah in a certain way, in a sense they pervert the meaning of Torah, and they're not even ready or willing at the later age when they mature to receive Torah Shebaal Peh. And I think, again this is my own feeling, that he is hinting at a contrast between Jewish learning and other religions, let's say Christianity, for example, where, you know, you just read the stories as they are. You know, it's almost like reading, you know, you read fairy tale books to your children, you read Bible books, you know, the Bible or the Old Testament, right, as they call it. That should be understood as a very interesting story. And sometimes, you know, you read Noah's Ark and, you know, it really sounds great. And you read the story of Adam and Eve, and it goes on and on, the Tower of Babel, and one story after the other, Abraham and Isaac. And you understand it on a very simple level, and from a Jewish perspective, that could be a very serious distortion of the truth. So as we said before, the Peleoetz puts Torah Shebaal Peh on the highest level here in his chapter called Avas Habonim Habonos, the essence of which is teaching and raising and educating your children. Why is Torah Shebaal Peh so high on the list? And the answer is because otherwise we expose our children to a great danger, a real possible pitfall, that they get so used to Torah Shebechsav lefi pshuto that they distort the true, deeper meaning of what's going on.
And still, isn't it, doesn't it go together? Like,
and that's what he's saying. It has to go together.
I mean, if you just do one, you know, you're going to be missing.
Right. But not only that, he's saying it from a perspective of an education, of how to raise your children, how to teach them Torah. You know, you could have said otherwise. Again, you could have said, as I gave the marshal before, you know, first finish math, you know, the prerequisite of math, the 101, you know, take psych 101, and then you go on to take the higher levels of psychology, but first get through the basics. and separate them. He's saying, no, you can't separate them. You have to integrate them together.
I see it more like, okay, you're learning math and you're learning spelling at the same time. That right. seems more...
Right, all the tools have to be given to you simultaneously, because otherwise, as he says before, as we said before, you know, you get too used to mikra, to understanding the Torah on a simple level, as if it was just a story about, you know, human beings. It's very nice, as I say, you know, a good night story, you know, to put your kids to bed with. No, the Ikar, the most important part of Torah, is the Torah Sheba'al Peh, the interpretations of Chazal, whether it be in Shas, whether it be in the Midrashim, because otherwise you can, Chas V'Shalom, heaven forbid, raise a child that goes off the path, and he'll deny Torah as a divine, Chas V'Shalom, as a divine work, and he'll see it just as a, you know, on a simple, superficial level, kind of like an interaction of stories. Oh, now, Chazal very often will absolutely change your understanding of the text.
Are you saying both together?
Are you okay? Are you feeling okay? Yeah, I'm just worried about you. I just,
I'm up at 2 in the morning.
Oh, very. Yeah, I didn't wake up till 4, so I'm way behind you. Yeah.
But that's what he's saying, both together.
That's what he's saying, both together. Now, at this point, what I'd like you to take a look at, it's a little bit complicated, but you'll see it on the top left. But it starts in the paragraph that's vertical, and then we go to the paragraph, the continuation is the paragraph that's horizontal, if you follow what I mean. Now, what we're reading now is a commentary on Pirkei Avos. And this is a fascinating piece that I want to learn with you. I think it has a tremendous insight for us.
What number?
And again, it's hard to see because the number 4 appears, but you have to know that you see where it says Divrei Yoel, number 4?
Yeah.
You don't see that? If
yeah.
you give me a page, I'll circle it for you.
No, I have number 4, yeah.
And underneath the 4, you'll see it says Divrei Yoel. No, if you don't see that, then I have to show it to you. You may be on the wrong page.
Yeah. That's thank you.
Okay then? Mm-hmm. But keep in mind that number 4 starts immediately on the right, and then there wasn't enough room, and it falls horizontally on the top. You'll see as we go along if you didn't follow what I said. Maybe I'm making it more complicated than it is, you know. The Mishnah says in Avos. Yeah, that we need what's called Yiras Chet Kodemes L'Chochmoso. Again, we're talking about a sequence. And the Mishnah addresses the question, what comes first and what comes second in the following choice that we have to make? There's one thing called Yira, which means fear of God, fear of sin. And there's something called Chochma, which means the study of Torah. What should come first? So the Mishnah says Yira has to come first. First you have to be afraid, you have to be a God-fearing Jew. And then after you've acquired this trait of fear of God, then and only then you can go ahead and study the Torah. If you do it the other way around, if you start with Chachma, with Torah, Ein Chachma so miskayemes, he will not succeed. In other words, the intellectual endeavor of delving into Torah ideas needs a prerequisite, and that has to be Yira. So the question is, what does that mean? We have a principle, which is also in Avos, in Pirkei Avos, Ein Bur Yirei Chet. An ignoramus could not be a God-fearing Jew, which seemed to mean that the prerequisite to becoming God-fearing is that you study Torah. So we're stuck in a vicious cycle of it. You're telling me, don't study Torah until you're a God-fearing Jew. And then you're telling me that unless you study Torah, you're an ignoramus and you have no possible way of getting to Yira. So we're in an apparent contradiction here. What comes first and what comes second? The Mishnah here that we're studying seems to indicate that first you have to have Yira, and only after you acquire Yira and you're a God-fearing Jew, then you could study Torah. But the Mishnah earlier in Pirkei Avos seems to assume that there's no way of acquiring Yira unless you're well versed and studied and you've studied Torah, because otherwise you're a boor. A boor means an ignoramus, and you can't be a Yirei Chet. So how do we reconcile this? So here you want to turn your page a little bit on the side, and you'll see the answer. He says the following. There are three different levels of Yira. In other words, the word fear with regard to God really breaks down into three different components, or shall I say, three different levels. The first level, we'll call it the lowest level, that's I'm afraid of punishment. Why am I afraid of God? Because He can punish me. Either He'll beat up my body, or He'll take away my possessions. That's what you call the basic lowest level of Yira. Then we move up a notch. The second level of Yira is fearing Onesh Gehenna. We're afraid of what's going to happen after death in the world to come. Will be punished in Gehenna. Okay. Now, these two are not the real McCoy genuine Yira. In other words, these are lower levels of Yira. The main level of Yira is a person who's afraid of God because of God's awesome, infinite omnipotence. He's aware of how great and how infinite God is. God is called the Rav Vishalit. God controls, He has dominion over everything. God is the root of all worlds. And anything that exists in this world is like nothing, is like non-existent compared to God. That's the highest level of genuine Yira. And therefore perhaps we could suggest the following. Ein bor yirei chet, a statement of Hillel. If you're an ignoramus, you can't be a true God-fearing Jew. What does it mean? That if you want to achieve the ultimate level, the highest level of fear of God, then you have to dedicate yourself to the study of Torah. Be Gia Ubamelus, with a lot of great work. Why? Because that highest level can only be achieved through the Torah, through our holy Torah. And when we dedicate ourselves and delve into the study of Torah, then there's a chance that we could reach this highest level of Yira. However, there's got to be a prerequisite to learning Torah. You have to have a level of Yira before you study Torah. Right? That's what we call Yiraso Kodemus L'Chochmaso. It has to come first. That's a reference to the lower levels of Yira. And even though those are not the real McCoy, genuine levels of Yira, those are not the truth of Yira, but nevertheless it's enough so that now, because you're afraid of the impact of sin and the punishment thereof, you're ready to learn our Torah. If you don't even have that basic level of Yira, then there's no possibility that you could study Torah. You're not ready for the study of Torah. Once you achieve that lower level of Yira, then you could go on and study Torah, and the Torah will facilitate, will allow you, will educate you and prepare you for the highest level of Yira. If you dedicate yourself to the study of Torah through Amelus and Yigia, then you'll reach the highest level of true Yira, and you'll see God as the infinite God. That's a brilliant, brilliant piece. Now let's go on in the Pella Yoetz, here in the same presentation. He says the following. Vilo, bekach yigbar laharchik bino milios mihayos ish yodet zayin umidvar sheker yarchikenu ki haemes yisod binyan. Here the Pella Yoetz presents the following thesis. With regard to educating, raising our children, he says we have to be very careful and try to do our utmost to guarantee that our children will stay far away from what we call midos ros, from negative attributes. He gives a mashal, he gives a a kind of a simile, he says, "Laharchik benomi milios ish yodet sayit." Now this is a pasuk. Does anybody know where this pasuk is? Ish yodet sayit. Who's described as a hunter?
It's
Esav. Esav, exactly. And Chazal say that yodet sayit means two things. On one level, it means he was a hunter, which he was, and on a deeper level, it means that he knew how to hunt people, meaning how to trick people. He would lie to them. He would present a false facade. And therefore, the Peleoit says that we have to do whatever we can, and bekach yigbar, we have to really, you know, crank ourselves up with a lot of energy to make sure that our children are far away from being what he calls an ish yodet sayid, someone who tries to fool and mislead others. And therefore, midvar sheker yarchikenu, make sure that your child stays away from sheker. Now, I don't know, again, you can talk
about...
No, sheker means false fabrication of the truth.
Lies.
Now, for example, if you think about your parents, you may remember that they really tried hard to make sure that everything you said was truth, and to see to it that you would stay far away from lying. And that's what he presents here. He says the MS, the truth, is Yesod HaBinyan. You know, every building needs a foundation. Without the foundation, the building will collapse. The foundation of everything is MS, he says, is truth. And there's nothing more important, this is paramount, in educating children, that we educate them never to lie, always to tell the truth. So what I'd like to study with you is a little bit of a biography about the Chazon Ish. Okay? Take a look. So you know what he looks like.
I didn't get a picture. He didn't take any pictures.
Well...
He didn't look in the mirror. This is what Mayor Twersky said.
Well, apparently somebody snuck in a camera somewhere. We have one...
Showed him a picture of himself, he said, "Is this my brother?" Because he never looked in the mirror.
Right, okay. So in any event, I'm just showing you a picture of the Chazon Ish. You know, he doesn't look so impressive here, although I like the glasses. They came back into style. This picture is probably about 60 years old. In any event, the Chazon Ish was dedicated to, amongst other things, but to the attribute of truth. And here's a little story about the Chazon Ish's feeling. His name was Rav Avram Yeshaya Karelitz. His dedication to truth. What happened was that the Chazon Ish, in his Beis Medrash, where he studied, he was very careful on a daily basis to daven what's called Mincha Gedola, the early Mincha, at 12:30, the middle of the day. And that he did during the week and even on Shabbos. What happened was, on one particular occasion, maybe because of weather conditions, I don't know why, they don't tell you this, they were having trouble of getting together a minyan. So at 12:30 there was no minyan and they couldn't start davening. They waited another 15 minutes. At 12:45 they found the 10th person for the minyan. But just at that moment, the Chazon Ish's brother-in-law, who was Rav Greinerman, Rav Shmuel, turns to the Chazon Ish and he says to him, "I have to go home at 1 p.m. because I made up with someone to meet him at 1 p.m. and that person will wait for me if I'm not there at 1. And if we start Mincha now at 12:45, I'm definitely going to come late to this meeting and so-and-so is going to be waiting for me. What should I do?" So you and I would have said, okay, so he'll wait a little bit. You know, we need you for a minyan. You're the 10th man. Says the Chazon Ish, There's not even a question here. For sure we're going to disband the minyan and you're going to go home because you told the man you would be there at 1 o'clock. And that's a commitment to truth. At that point, everybody left and there was no minyan. So again, this is the Chazon Ish. Now you and I might not think it's such a big deal. He'll find another minyan. But this is the Chazon Ish that every day of his life used to daven at 12:45. But if you made an appointment... and you got to be there. That's a commitment to truth. The Ben Yehoyada, otherwise known as the Ben Ishchai, one of the greats of Baghdad, he writes that if you take a look at the word sheker, which means lying, he says the following, that if a person makes, you know, he speaks a straight out lie, it doesn't really have so much of a of an alluring power. You know, who takes him seriously? He's lying. But he says that your pathological liars are of a different ilk. What they do is they integrate some truth at the very beginning of their story, and then people become very excited about it. You know, they think, oh, he's telling something true, and then he adds a whole fabrication into his story. Says the Ben Ishchai that if you take a look at the word sheker, if you just drop the shin, you're left with kuf and resh. Kuf and resh is kar, meaning something that's cold. No one gets warmed up and gets excited. You know, no one's fired up by somebody who's shekar. You know, it's meaning all he does is speak lies. But if he mixes with the sheker a little bit of emes, then everybody gets all warmed up. And if you take the word sheker and you take the word emes, take a look what happens. You take the aleph from the word emes, and you put it together with the shin, which is the first letter of the word sheker, and once you make that combination, you integrate emes and sheker, you end up with esh. You know, everybody gets fired up, everyone gets excited, because he started telling a true story. That's what happened, if you remember, with the Meraglim. You know, the Meraglim didn't initially start down debunking the land of Israel. You know, first they said, oh, it's a beautiful land, take a look at these unbelievable fruits. Once they got the attention of people, then they were off on their own. The Maharal in Prague has another similar idea, and he says the following, that it's very critical with regard to MS that we have no admixture of sheker. We can't even add one little letter of falsehood. You may say, well, all right, I added a little bit to the story, it's a little bit of falsification, nishkefelch, it's not so terrible. No. He says, if you take the word emes, and you just remove one letter, that's the letter of aleph, you're left with mace. You know, truth is something that gives life, but the opposite of truth brings death. So he says, don't even consider missing one letter of truth. You have to have all pure, 100% unadulterated truth, emes. If you drop the aleph and you say, okay, what's the difference? I only left out one letter, then you're left with a terrible situation. Getting back to the Peleoids, he writes the following. Harbe chaverim haroim osim. What that means is that chaverim roim are a bad crowd. If a youngster is allowed to hang out with a bad crowd, he calls them chaverim roim, that could have a tremendous influence on the child to take him down, down, down. And therefore he says, lachein yezar chayel, he should gather together all of his energies as a parent, laharchik bonov, to make sure that his children stay far away min ha-chevrusa, from rubbing shoulders and being friendly, b'chol abol yodo, from anybody that the child, you know, the child, if he's left free, he'll just link up with anyone who seems like a lot of fun. But rather, yishtadil alei b'chol o sheyelchu b'derech tovim, make sure he goes together on the road and he associates with the right influence. This is what we call the social influence. And it's a very powerful element.
The biggest challenge is with this crazy internet and all this.
Right. There's such a challenge that even if you're careful about who your child is hanging out with, or hanging around with, you still might expose him to a danger. You know, when he's alone in a room with a computer. So we really have to be very careful.
Yeah, it's working everywhere.
Yeah, it's very, it's very difficult. It's very difficult. I want to share with you the insights of Rabbi Meir Shapiro. I don't know if you heard of him. He was called the Baal Daf Yomi. He was the one who created the Daf Yomi. And he analyzes the pasuk. You remember that when Moshe Rabbeinu appears in front of Paro, he has in his hand a staff. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells him to throw down the staff and it'll turn into a tanin. Okay, a tanin is some sort of a serpent. And Rav Meir Shapiro offers a whole new insight into reading this verse in the Torah. A whole new way, whole new perspective. He says the following. The most powerful influence on a person is his sviva, his social atmosphere. And he says that the power of this sviva, this atmosphere, is so such that even a person who is tov bioser, he's a great guy, alul lehafech lios chayot tzmeis dam. He can be converted by the influence of people around him, if it's a negative influence, into someone who's bloodthirsty. If, on the other hand, he's a person who is mushchas, he's on the lowest level, garua bioser, if he hangs out with the right people, they can elevate him, osu lishtanos lishtaper, he'll become better. So Moshe Rabbeinu was asked by Paro to explain what's going on. That these are people, the people of Israel, who have reached the lowest level. I mean, they're slaves for so many centuries. So Moshe Rabbeinu tells him the following. Afal pichen, even though Bnei Yisrael are so mushpalim ubzuyim, here in Mitzrayim they've reached this lowest level, they are downtrodden, they're humiliated, they have almost no tzuras enosh, they don't even look like human beings, they've been so beaten for so long. But nevertheless, there's a potential to bring them up, to uplift them to a new level, a very high level, as long as they can free themselves from the Egyptian influence, which is so mushkas, which is so negative and polluted and corrupt. And now Moshe Rabbeinu wants to demonstrate. He takes the Mat Elokim, and on this staff is engraved the name of God, the ineffable name of God. And with this staff, Moshe Rabbeinu is able to achieve great things, great miracles. However, Hashem says to him, Hashlech lifnei Paro, take this staff, lifnei Paro, throw it in front of Paro, meaning that Paro now becomes the representative of the negative, corrupt influences, the polluted society of Mitzrayim. And what happens to the staff? That same staff that's able to achieve miracles and change the laws of nature because it has the name of God, it's so holy, that same staff becomes a serpent. Why? A serpent is most dangerous, one of the most dangerous animals, creatures that we have. And all of this is because it's v'hishlich lifnei Paro, because of the influence of Paro. However, as soon as Moshe Rabbeinu picks up the staff and takes it back, the staff again reverts back to be a Mat Elokim, to the staff of God, because it's in the hands of Moshe Rabbeinu. This symbolizes how much the sviva, the atmosphere, and the social environment in which we live can have a tremendous influence on a person. Now, what I'd like you to do at this point is turn to page 2. Do you have page 2? And here we're reading an essay in the Pele Yoetz, which is called Avas Atzmo, which literally means the love one has for himself. And he says the following, it's natural for a person to love themselves. And he goes on to say that ha'oeves atzmo yosim in ha'olam, he might love himself more than he loves anything else in the world. And for the sake of his own love, self-love, kol asher la'ish, anything he has, all his possessions, yitain, he would be willing to give v'ad nafsho for the sake of his being, of his existence. So for example, if let's say Rachmana Litzlan, a person needs a very potent treatment in a hospital, and it'll, you know, for whatever reason it'll cost him all the money that he has, but if he needs it desperately, he's not going to count his money. Why? Because he loves himself more than anything else. Now, what we'd like to study here is Reb Tzvi Elimelech Midinov. He was one of the great Hasidic giants in what's called Galicia, which is near Hungary. And he wrote a sefer called the Bnei Yisachar. He was named Elimelech after his uncle, who you may have heard of, was Reb Elimelech Milizhinsk, whose brother was Reb Zusha. And this Reb Elimelech Midinov was a Talmud of the Chozem Milublin, one of the famous luminaries in the Hasidic world. He was also a Talmud of the Ohev Yisrael, the Apta Rav. And he was...
Who was Ohev Yisrael?
The Ohev Yisrael was called the Apta Rav. Heschel was his name.
What's his name?
Heschel.
Avram Yehoshua.
Yehoshua Heschel, right.
And the one minute, there was a reformed or conservative Avram Yehoshua.
Right. That he was a... great-grandson maybe of the Apta Rav. Yeah. But in any event, the Igra de Pirka, which is one of the various works that was authored by Reb Tzvi Elimelech Midinov, and this work is a presentation of the ideas of the tzaddikim, of the various great Jewish leaders. This particular piece puts the emphasis on tzedakah, on giving charity. And of course, a person should give kefi yecholto, you know, based on his financial situation. However, the Gemara tells us that giving charity is a skula nifla. It has a tremendous inherent skula power to bring about health in the case of chas shalom, someone who's sick, and even in the case of somebody who's spiritually ill, meaning he's suffering from chait, from sin, tzedakah has a tremendous power. Now, there's something paradoxical here, because the Gemara tells Suksubus that when you're spending money for a mitzvah, you should not spend above 20% of your possessions. And you'll see this on line 3. It says, Hamavazbeis al yivazbeis yoser michomesh. But here's the insight of the Igra de Pirka, and he based himself on the Balatanya, the Alter Rebbe of Chabad. When the Gemara tells us that you shouldn't spend more beyond 20%, the Gemara is talking about someone who doesn't have sin, Mishalo Chata. But if he's a sinner, and his life is at stake, so to speak, his life is on the line, if you could use that phrase, then Kol Asher Yeshlo Yite Be'ad Nafsho. He should give everything, every last dime that he has. And I'll prove it to you. If you talk about physical health, a person will be willing to give up all his possessions, every last dime that he has, in order to save his own life. How much more so if he wants to save his life in an eternal way, in Netzach, and he's guilty of sin, then he's obligated to give up all of his possessions if he has to, in order to achieve that goal of saving his nefesh, saving his soul from going to the wrong place, if you know what I mean, after 120 years. And therefore, this rule that says don't spend more than 20% of your possessions, that doesn't apply in the case of someone who has chet and he wants to save himself from going, again, as I said, down to Be'er Shachas, you know, down to the other place.
Be'er Shachas?
Be'er Shachas is a very interesting phrase in the Torah for H-E-L-L, if you know what I'm saying.
I've got the picture, but I've never heard that.
Yeah, Be'er Shachas. That's the destructive place where you know you might be shoveling coal for a long time. You don't want to go there. That's not the place you want to visit. And usually when you visit there, you end up staying there for a long time. So in order to avoid that, you want to give tzedakah. You want to give a lot of charity. Now the Peli Yoetz, in this very same presentation called Avas Atzmo, says the following: Ein shum sone ba'olam yochel laharlo kimaseu mimenu. He says the following: there are many people who think that, you know, there's no enemy or adversary in this world who can do me bad, who can do me under. Now, maybe on a physical level, you could always say, well, I'm well prepared to take on any adversary. You know, I have a black belt in karate. You know, I've been studying martial arts. But that maybe. But when it comes to the spiritual realm, there is someone out there, a powerful force, who can really trip us up. And that's the Yetzer Hara. And therefore, we have to be careful not only avoiding anything that could destroy our bodies, that could be physically harmful, but as well, we have to worry about things that could, you know, allure us on a spiritual level to do sin. And then he quotes a very famous statement of the Gemara in Sota. It's also in the Zohar. And the Gemara says, "Ein adam chote elam kei nichnas bo ruach shtus." That if a person had his wits about him, he would not fall prey to the Yetzer Hara, be able to overcome the Yetzer Hara. We're going to have to study exactly how, and that's what we want to study here. But sometimes a person becomes a shota. He becomes an idiot, so to speak. You know, he's no longer working with all his marbles. He's not thinking clearly. And if lefamim, if at times he becomes a shota, then he, you know, if he thinks that this adversary is trying to trip him up, is not really a formidable adversary that he can overcome him, then he's talking shtuyot. He's talking stupidities. He's basically on a spiritual level suicidal. Ma'abid atzmo l'das. He has to realize that at every moment, at every step of his life, he has to be careful not to fall prey to this ruach shtus, to this, you know, this mood or this state of mind that takes over him, in which he becomes a shota. He loses his clarity of thought and his ability to make the right moral decisions. Now, I mentioned to you before, Reb Tzvi Elimelech Midinov, he wrote another work, which is called the Igra de Kala. As I said before, he's a prolific writer, published many, many books. And the Igra de Kala is a commentary on the Torah, with a lot of original insights. And here, if you'll take a look, in Parshas Achrimos, he says the following: how does a person face the adversary called the Yetzer Hara that's trying to suck him in, that's trying to allure him, that's overpowering him to do a sin? And he's tempted to do the sin. He says the following: Hashem has commanded us in the midst of Kiddush Hashem, which means that if, let's say, somebody wants to force me to bow down to an idol, I have to be willing to give up my life. And the Did of a Rebbe here says that it's so natural to a Jew to be willing to give up his life rather than worship an idol. This is something that's inherent in our genes, in the genetic structure, that so many Jews throughout Jewish history were willing to give up their lives and die rather than violate something which would be idolatry and a denial of God. Now, according to the principles of the Torah, when a person sins, let's say he deliberately sins, he's really in a sense denying God, because he's saying, you know, God told me not to do this, and I'm going to deliberately rebel against God. So what he's doing is he's thrusting himself into the dominion of what we call the Sitra Achra, which is another kind of an anti-God figure. You know, it's the powers of evil. And this is called Ruach Shtus. Ruach Shtus means he thinks, he makes an idiocentric kind of choice, and he says, you know what, this is a sin, but it's not Kvira, I'm not denying God. What he fails to realize is that by making that decision to violate the will of God, if he's a deliberate rebellious person, he's really denying God. He's saying that God doesn't have the power here to demand and to mandate how I live my life. So if the Jew is willing to give up his life not to deny God, you know, rather than worship the idol, he's willing and ready, and that's what the Jews have done throughout history, to give up his life, then how much more so Should he be ready to overcome and subdue any kind of powerful influences or temptations that allure him to violate sin? Because if he violates the sin, it's also like he's worshipping an idol. He's also basically saying that I am the God, and I am the my autonomous, I can autonomously mandate for myself what's right and wrong. That also is a rebellion. So if he's willing to give up his life rather than rebel against God, in the case of Kiddush Hashem, then with that mindset, he should be willing to give up everything, all his desires and all his temptations, overcome them and subdue them, so as not to violate arayos, for example, not to violate immoral relationships, even though the desire to do so is so powerful. But he should realize that he would give up his whole life rather than worship an idol. And in another commentary of the same Sefer on Parshas Ekev, which you'll see on the bottom right, he also points out that the Chachmei HaEmes, meaning those who taught us truth, and they ask the question, what is the best way of overcoming temptation? What they ask you to do is to think in your mind how you'd be willing to give up your life rather than violate a very severe punishment, a very severe prohibition. Okay, my friends, we'll stop here. What we're up to here is on the top left, you'll see number 6. So if you want to hold on to these pages, please make a note of where we got up to, so we'll know, you know, next week where to pick it up. And thanks for coming, and I hope you got something out of it. If you get a chance to review some of the ideas, that would be great. And I wish everyone a good night. And that's about it. Dress warmly because it's cold. You know what?